Chaykin interviewing Bennett and Alice Epstein on Sunday, March 15th, 1998. Bennett Epstein, where and when were you born?
I was born in 1923. Born in 1923 in the Women's Hospital of Manhattan in New York.
So you grew up in New York City?
New York City, lived in Mount Vernon, really in my formative years, ages about 10 to 16 when I went off to college.
So Mount Vernon during that period of time?
Yeah, it was a really formative years.
And so your parents, what did your father do, your mother?
My father was a wholesale salesman of women's lingerie. My mother was a housewife.
And what was your life like at that time? What are your memories?
Memories? Good. You know, happy, basically happy memories.
Brothers, sisters?
No, only sibling. I was concerned about that, and I can remember my mother saying, if you had, then Bennett, when I was about six, Bennett, if you had a brother or a sister, you'd have to share your bedroom. It was the only consolation I got.
You lived in an apartment?
Lived in an apartment in Mount Vernon. Lived in a house with my mother's parents and her sister.
Ah, so it was like an extended family.
Extended family. There were six of us in the house.
And then
we moved to Mount Vernon so Bennett could get an official loft.
Fresh air.
Yeah.
Official loft. Fresh
yeah.
air.
Yeah.
And your father went into New York City to work.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Did you have any kind of Jewish education?
Very limited. Came time for my father came from an Orthodox background. My mother came, although my mother's mother had religious instincts, her father wasn't interested at all, so.
Were they immigrants?
Yep, they came over, my mother came over when she was two. Okay. My father was born in this country. In fact, his mother was born in this country and lived on the east side.
Uh-huh.
The whole time
he
spoke with a heavy Yiddish accent.
The whole time?
The whole time, yeah. My grandparents and my mother and sister came over in steerage in 1898, and my mother said...
From where?
From Hungary.
Uh-huh.
One of them up all the time, the whole 2 weeks of the trip, to keep the rats off the children.
Mm.
That's where they started.
And then your father went to work?
My father went to work at 18. He didn't go to college. He went to work to help to support his next younger brother, who went off to medical school.
Hmm.
My father's father started a business in 1895 that's still working today.
Oh, wow.
And it's going to three generations and maybe soon a fourth generation in the business.
That's very nice.
Yeah.
And where did you go to college?
Columbia.
And what induced you to go to Columbia? Was that...
Oh, that was my ideal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then because there was not much money around, my folks moved into New York and they moved in the west side near Columbia and I walked to school.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so you got your undergraduate degree there?
Undergraduate degree in chemical engineering, and then was hired as a graduate assistant. In those days, that was a
big thing.
And worked for it 1 year, and then on graduation I had applied for a commission in the Navy and was rejected because I was colorblind. But the Army...
Did you know you were colorblind?
Oh yeah,
uh-huh.
I knew that from the time I was about 6 years old. Then the Army didn't have that problem. I was fine to be a buck private in the infantry. So one year into that graduate program, I got drafted in the Army. And
where did you serve?
Served in Europe. I've got to go back and talk about my religious education.
Okay, let's go back and talk about
it.
Okay.
When I was 12, my folks realized, my father came from an Orthodox background, realized it would be a shanda in the family if I were not bar mitzvah. So then they went to the rabbi of the conservative synagogue, who had great doubts about taking me on to train me in a year, had me study with the wife of the reform rabbi, and after a few months, he thought I made enough progress that he took me on.
Hmm.
So I got the training, I did the Torah and the Haftorah, complete with the trope, and when I was done, Rabbi Margolis walked over to me and said, the Torah was great, the Haftorah was putrid. I don't remember that.
What a compliment. But did you have the traditional party? And?
Yeah, what my parents could afford is, my mother and grandmother did all the baking, held it, I think in the basement of the shul.
The shul, right.
Yeah, usual, yeah, that kind of.
So you had all that. So that was your Jewish training.
Jewish training. When I got to Columbia, I joined the little, they had a Jewish student group that had been started by Benjamin Cardoza and Mr. Sulzberger and a couple of other people in the 20s. Okay, a tiny, tiny program, maybe a 10 or 12 kids went would have program because it was Columbia. Molly Pecan came and spoke to the dozen kids Marie Schwartz and
So did you realize that you were getting special things at that time, or did you just expect it to have Marie Schwartz come?
it was something of a surprise.
Uh-huh.
But they came to Columbia.
So even then, you were already identifying with the Jewish.
Yeah, always did.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Couldn't grow up in these days, really.
In those days, many people did grow up without identifying.
Yes.
Because it was the norm. So if you did that, you were already showing
your interest. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I went overseas, and we were going through Belgium, Holland, not in Germany, but in Belgium and Holland, the small towns we were in, I always sought out, so tried to find out where the Jews were. And I found out, each town there'd be 50 or 100 Jews, and the Germans had taken them.
Mm-hmm.
And there were one or two left that managed to save one way or another, and nobody knew what had happened to the rest.
Mm-hmm.
But then, I was wounded, and I was in a
army. How were you wounded?
I was in combat.
Yeah.
Basically, it's random. A lot of steel flying around,
uh-huh.
A lot of people.
Right.
And when a steel and person meet,
you're wounded.
You're wounded. I was in the hospital, and Stars and Stripes came out when they were liberating the camps. Then I knew what had happened to the Jews.
You mean, so you actually did not, do you think the people really did not know what happened to the Jews when you were in Belgium?
No, in Holland.
In Holland?
Quartered in the house of a priest, and he and I would talk in the evening.
Uh-huh.
And he even brought a little Jewish girl for me to see that a Catholic family had saved out.
Mm-hmm.
No, they didn't know.
Because there are reports now that some people did know. They saw.
But these are the common people.
Uh-huh.
These are ordinary people, and they didn't know.
Okay.
So when I came back in 96, in late fall of 95, I was back on the Columbia campus to complete my master's, and I ran the UJA campaign.
Ah.
$2,000-$3,000, maybe.
And what year was that?
46.
So 1946, after the war and you returned, you went back to get your master's in
Columbia, in chemical engineering.
In chemical engineering. So then so you've been in this from the very beginning.
All my adult life.
Yeah, all your adult life.
Yeah,
okay.
When I came to town, I was living in the Y, 10th and Washington.
Yeah, but in 1946, that's where you were back at Columbia, and you got your master's.
It came the fall of 95, was through by the summer of 96.
Of 96, then what?
Got the job at DuPont.
Ah, okay. So you came to DuPont at that time.
Yeah.
So that's when you came and you lived in the YMCA?
Yeah. I think it was, started like about $7 a week and finally got all the way up to $99 a week rent.
Rent?
Yeah.
At the Y?
Yeah, tiny little room. And I was working day shift and I was in town maybe a couple of months, and one day when I was free during the day, I walked down to the Federation office on 7th Street, introduced myself.
Excuse me, you were working night shift, not day shift.
I was off day shift, yeah.
Yeah, you worked night shift, thank you.
Well, yeah.
You worked night shift, so you were off during the day.
Well, rotating shift, actually, but when, yeah.
What was your job at DuPont?
As a chemical engineer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, started out as a chemical, as a shift supervisor.
Uh-huh.
Chemical engineer, yeah.
And so at that time, they were beginning to hire Jews?
Yes.
Because during World War II, they still only hired Jews when there was a hardship.
A special case, not Joe Lebowski.
Right.
In the early 40s.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah, man.
So you must have been one of the early ones that was hired.
I had to tell you a tale about that. I was working shift work and said to my, I arrived in late August, early September, and within a week or two, told my boss I needed time off for the holidays. And he said, of course, he was a lovely man. He said, oh, of course. I gave him a note in the log. Ben, please call Frank at the end of the night shift. So I called him at about 7:30 in the morning, and Frank said, well, we've run into a little problem. The people downtown, as the research manager, since we've never had anybody Orthodox here before, okay, if I wanted to go to services, I was shunned Orthodox, okay. And we never had anybody Orthodox here before. They want to know if they'll give you the time off this year, will you take it as part of your vacation in subsequent years?
Mm. And what was your response?
I said, sure. So for a number of years, I got 2 weeks vacation.
Minus
a couple of days for the holidays.
For the holidays.
Two or three, depending on how it fell.
But they didn't give you any hard time.
No, they had no, they never raised any objections to my taking it.
Uh-huh.
My own time.
And so beginning in 1946, you're saying?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And then how long did you stay at this, in this role at DuPont?
At DuPont? Well, after a few years I was off shift work, supervised small research jobs, still as an engineer. And then what was a big deal at the time got transferred downtown into a staff function evaluating projects, and that was kind of a big deal. But at that point, I'd been working for DuPont 7 years, decided I needed something to change, and then went back to MIT. Resigned from the company,
uh-huh.
Went back to MIT.
And you got your
doctorate.
There. Your doctorate.
And, 3 years, and also a wife.
But you, when you had been in Wilmington during that early period, you had been dating here?
Oh, sure, yeah.
And so, and you've been involved, you said you went down to the Federation during those very early days.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Roque Lieberman was kind of in charge of this aspect of things, working for Ben Coder. And
Ben Coder was the executive director of the Jewish Federation of Delaware.
Yeah.
He was the first one.
Yeah. And we started the Young Adult Division in those days.
So you were one of the originators of the Young Adult Division of the Jewish Federation.
And Lou Finger and I in 48 co-chaired a fund drive for the Young Adult Division. It was the first one. And I can remember.
This is before Alice.
Oh, this is before pre-Alice.
Right.
This is pre-Alice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Proto-Alice, whatever. And so Lou and I shared it. And I don't know how much time I want to spend on it. We had some interesting experiences. But I do want to talk about, we had a special gifts dinner, $50, at the Hunter Remember the old Hunter
restaurant?
In the
Hercules building.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, $50 was a lot of money in those days.
Yeah.
And
we had, there were maybe 20 young people there.
I think we gave much less than 50.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you were married. Yeah. I was single and I was making a lot.
Yeah.
And to me, a huge sum of money. I started at 300 a month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so.
I think at that time, Sonny said that if he made $75 a week for the rest of his life, he would accept it as a deal.
And that's the same thing, you know, that's a little over 300
yeah.
a month. It was a good salary in those days. So we held this, and I would say there were maybe 20 or so people there. I think I could probably even, I think, you know, Fannie Nathan's, I would guess, was one of them. There are a number of young people. But what I do remember, at the end of the meeting, we started to break up. I was chairing the meeting. At the end of the meeting, Milton Kutz, who was there, rushed up to me and said, "Announce the total, announce the total."
And what was the total, do you remember?
I don't remember. We hadn't been keeping the total. We didn't know anybody, you know.
You didn't know you were supposed to do that.
We were not that sophisticated.
So I would say that you've been in Jewish fundraising for your total adult life.
Yeah. Yeah.
From the beginning to the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think you're going to keep it on forever.
Well, you know, I don't think you ever, you never deserve a complete
no,
rest.
No.
I was, a little offended by people who said they deserve a vacation.
So now, at this point, you go up to Boston. You go to MIT.
Yeah.
And you get your PhD.
Yeah.
And how did you meet Alice?
There's a fundraising story attached. My aunt and uncle lived in Norwalk, where her folks lived. And her mother was soliciting for Red Cross and stopped off at
for the only time in her life.
and stopped off at my aunt and uncle's house. And my aunt, who's the one I lived with in Mount Vernon, what are the girls doing? They'd seen Alice and her sister riding bikes in front of their house. So what are the girls doing now? And Alice's mother said, "Oh, my daughter, one daughter's married, the other's single, and living up in Cambridge, going to Harvard, getting a master's in education."
Wow.
Okay.
Oh, wow. I can see you put two and two together.
6 months later.
8 months.
Yeah, 8 months
later. So you took a hook, line, and sinker, and you called Alice you went back?
We made a date. Alice couldn't remember my name. So she had stumbled over. She lived in the house with a bunch of
It was a senior moment.
Very early.
25.
Very early.
So I showed up the door to a bunch of young people living in this house. All girls? Or
no.
Yeah, some young students at Harvard. And Alice stationed one of her friends at the front door to meet me. Then went and knocked on Alice's door and said, "It's Ben! It's Ben!"
So that took off immediately, I can see.
Yeah, it did, really.
Yeah. You had a meeting of the minds.
Yeah.
And
she looked right to me.
Yeah.
When she opened the door.
You knew this was it.
Yeah. I did.
And
yeah.
Did you also knew it was it?
No.
But it didn't take
but
you
I
long.
Was willing to try. Anyway.
Okay.
Well, I tell you, we know the moment when it really was it. We
yeah.
both had rotten colds.
It was in June, I think.
Yeah.
That was probably in March when we met, something
yeah.
like that. And
yeah.
and in June we went on something in outside of Boston, and we both had terrible colds.
No, I think we went to the ball game.
That was a ball game that
yeah,
time.
We go to Fenway occasionally.
Yeah.
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 Right.
We went there, we both had rotten colds.
But how did you know it was it?
We had a very good time.
Oh. Okay. Okay. Well, that's a good way to tell.
Yeah.
He asked me to marry him in October, and we were married in December.
Oh. That didn't take long.
We didn't know each other more than 8 months.
We were married. Who was the oak and who was the cypress?
Oh, well.
The rabbi and his little
unknown rabbi.
Oration.
Yes.
To find one of us as an oak and one as a cypress.
We never knew which was which.
You know, my grandfather, who was there close to 90 at that time, might have been 90 at that time, tried to cut this short by regularly shouting, "Mazel tov."
probably couldn't hear that well.
No, he could hear fine. He could hear fine.
The rabbi went on. Every time the rabbi took a breath.
The wedding was at Alice's folks' home. Yeah, that married her folks.
So now you brought Alice back to Wilmington.
Yep.
And then what was your job with DuPont at that point? Because I take it you went back to DuPont.
Oh, yeah.
And they hired you back without any problem.
Oh, yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, while I was at MIT, the research director visited the school and made a point of getting in touch with me and letting me know that if I came back, that they would heal my service, which meant that my previous 7 years would count toward my vacation.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
And your experience in Wilmington was good enough so that you wanted to come back?
Yeah. Oh,
did you have other offers?
Sure. Look, Alice and I went out to Standard of Indiana.
It was eventful.
Where Alice, when she excused herself to go to the bathroom, we were invited out to dinner by the guy who was my host there, who was one of the research managers, who happened to be Jewish. Nate Fragan was his name. And presumably Fragan, right? Okay. And Alice excused herself, we were at dinner, Alice excused herself to go to the ladies' room and was gone a long time. And Nate and I were making small conversation. She finally came back. She was wearing a necklace of pearls, and she'd broken the string of pearls, and they were all over the bathroom floors. She had to take the time to collect her pearls.
Were they real pearls?
No.
No.
Even so,
you didn't want to leave them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you chose DuPont again.
Yeah.
You decided. And now what was your role? Had it changed any?
No.
But you got to describe your first job.
Oh, yeah. My boss, sat down. I was assigned to the group that made Delrin, one of the plastics at the front name.
Delrin?
Delrin, D-E-L-R-I-N.
Okay.
And it was in the development stage, and I was hired into that group. And the manager of the group said, well, we got together, you were coming back, we knew a lot about you, and we were very anxious to find a job that would, take advantage of your experience and training. And so what we would like you to do is develop the color line. This kind of color?
Yeah.
Develop the color line for Delrin. And I can remember saying, Henry, that's great, but you should know I'm colorblind.
So we changed that.
No.
Oh,
no.
We used instrumental analysis.
Uh-huh.
And the guy who had the job before me, he'd been going on some time, it wasn't going too well,
uh-huh.
So they moved me into it, was not colorblind, was using his own eyes.
And wasn't satisfactory.
Yeah, really, you needed an objective measurement, which I had to use, but much better after that.
And then, so you were successful at that?
Oh, yeah.
And so then, what was your next, what were some of the interesting areas that you moved into at DuPont?
Okay. One of my earliest successes was I was given a job that, by this point I was managing a small research program where we had technicians running on shift work. And my job was to evaluate the impurities that were going into a nylon chemical. And really the first significant accomplishment I made was simply to notice, it wasn't part of my job, I noticed that certain impurities actually improved the life of the catalyst, which was essential to run the reaction. And from that, observation, then the catalyst people were able changed the whole direction of research on the catalyst.
But that you wouldn't get a patent for that?
No.
Uh-huh.
Well, I don't actually know. We applied for a patent on it. And the company decided not to take it out because they didn't want to reveal the work.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
It was a secret.
It was a secret. And Monsanto, about 8 or 9 years later,
came out with it.
issued the patent. They figured it out significantly later. But by that time,
we were well entrenched.
We had all the advantages. Of that discovery. And that was after I did a little more of those kinds of things was when I got transferred down to this, because then I was, you know, I was kind of, was highly rated among
your peers.
Got this backwards and forward. This is before I, one of the significant things I did, this is before I ever went back to MIT. I had done this piece of work.
So they remembered you.
I was highly rated, so I got the job in the staff group downtown. So when I came back, then they were looking for me. And I worked for, after coming back, worked for 3 years at various, I did that Delrin coloring job, which went very, very well, and a couple of other small things. And then was assigned a supervisory job in the Teflon group. And worked at that for some time. Then decided really, I did not enjoy supervisory work. It went very well. I can remember, I viewed my job then as not making the technical contributions, but helping my people do it. And I can remember all my people who had been rated C's and B's, the next evaluation period were all D's and B's and A's. Every one of them went up a step. And then came time for my evaluation. I can remember my boss saying, "Ben, we have not been able to identify what you've done."
He said, "Look at all these people."
I said, "Bud." Good point. It then gets a little hazy.
Were you?
Then I got transferred downtown again. Again, in similar kind of
Being transferred downtown
Into that group.
Is that a plus?
Because you're talking to the management every day about what should, what should be done. But then there was a job opening down at Parkersburg. And my boss, with whom I had worked for years one way or another, we got along very well. The boss came to me and said, "Ben, we have an opening in Parkersburg. I'm not going to ask you to take it, but I'm telling you about it. Go home and talk to Alice, who we knew, over the weekend and see if you want to take it. If you want to take it, we'll ask you." Alice and I talked it over for the week. Because Alice and I talked over the weekend and decided with parents aging and, our kind of close family kinds of backgrounds, we decided we didn't really want to go to Parkersburg. Although I knew it was a career opportunity, I was turning down a career opportunity. Went back to my boss and said, Monday morning, and said, "Jerry, I don't think I want to take that job." He said, "Okay, we won't ask you."
How about that?
Because if he had asked me and I'd refused,
it would have been a black mark. Well, you were in a very fine situation. That was very nice.
Always gotten along very well.
And so you stayed in this research aspect of it?
For a few, I had a job for a few years then in a product group that managed, as it happened, the same Delrin that I had worked on before. This is a management function with one boss, and I was one of four people doing various aspects of that management job. And then I went back out in the station, developed a process for making glass reinforced nylon that was highly successful.
These are things for which you received patents.
I worked for a boss at that point, in line.
Yeah.
Who, okay.
That's all right.
Okay. Guy was an anti-Semite.
Well, that's fine.
Okay. Mel Cohan suffered under it for much, much longer. And he said, I don't think we ought to get a patent on that. We'll just use it as a secret. If I had gotten a patent, it would have been very valuable to my career and would have been a larger bonus.
Yeah, so you couldn't have done it without your boss's approval.
It would have been very hard.
Uh-huh.
Would have been very hard. The other time that happened, you know, I told you about this other success
had. That was not anti-Semitism.
No, that was a business judgment that I couldn't really fault.
Uh-huh.
But this one was clearly the motivation was different.
Were you aware of it at the time? Were you aware that this man was anti-Semitic?
More in hindsight, but more by what he did to Mel Cohan,
uh-huh.
who suffered under him for a long time, than what he did to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then I went into this business group for 3 years, and then out of that I was given a job as a special assistant for the division director, engineering plastics division director, and that was a distinct promotion.
Mm. So you were director of?
I worked for the director.
Oh, you worked for the director.
Engineering plastic. No, this is the whole business.
Oh, this was.
Yeah, mm-hmm. engineering plastics business,
uh-huh.
which is a major business for them.
Uh-huh.
And I was shuffling around hundreds of millions of dollars.
Oh, wow.
But never saw, it's funny, you know, but when it came to business experience, running Federation, I had never hired anybody, I had never fired anybody, I had never handled a single green dollar when I was in this budget. It was all paper.
Uh-huh.
And so I had no really the kind of business experience that Sonny or Bernie and
other
people
had.
So when it came to that stuff, the Federation, I needed
help.
At any rate, where's the whole we going now?
So now you're head of research for the business. No,
I was doing the business stuff.
The business stuff, right.
Okay. Then went back and then did the glass reinforced nylon. And that was
very successful.
Hugely successful.
Yeah.
DuPont's still the leader in the business.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And then after that, I was just about finishing up that job. I mean, I worked on one or two other little things. And came into this super tough nylon discovery. And that was patented, and that I was well compensated for.
And was DuPont generous in its recognition of what you had done?
The research director who gave me the bonus said it was the largest one he had ever given.
Oh, wow.
Well, and then you got the two awards.
Yeah, and then this led to promotions then to the top level of bench research people,
uh-huh.
equivalent roughly to a research manager job, okay? And the compensation that went, of course, you know, the
compensation.
And
the compensa- title was?
The
what was the title?
The title was, there's several levels of research fellow. This was the highest level of research fellow at that time. At that time called a departmental research fellow, now called a DuPont research fellow.
Uh-huh.
And led
so
that,
you were in the highest level of research at DuPont?
Of bench people. Okay. Now they're still reporting to directors of research.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
But at that point it was at the highest you could go.
Yeah, except in management.
Uh-huh.
And it was equivalent to an intermediate management position.
Uh-huh. And so you won several honors.
Yes,
that.
Yeah.
And what were the honors?
One was called the Peterson Medal, named after the one DuPont Nobel Prize winner.
Uh-huh.
And the other was the Lavoisier, joining the Lavoisier Academy, which, you know, DuPont's had, I don't know, well over 100,000 research people, I imagine, and there's something like maybe 50 Lavoisier.
Oh, wow.
academy.
That's quite an honor.
Yeah.
Both of them are great honors.
Yeah.
So you must be proud of that.
Oh, yeah. You know, I've had, you know, a very satisfactory career.
So your life at DuPont was a satisfying one.
Yeah. I never heard, you know, I told you I worked for one guy who was almost certainly an anti-Semitic. Let me play something else into this. At the time I was doing this research, Alice and I were deeply involved in the civil rights movement. And not everybody in DuPont was happy with that. And certainly this one guy was not. And I was, at the time, I was taking all kinds of time off from work to go down to the lobby of the legislature in Dover and the like. And I was working with this guy.
Yeah.
Okay. When I asked for time, he said, "I can't fight that," said he.
Uh-huh. So you were leading a dual life.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that
brings me to the second part of your life. The work was one part, but your involvement in the community, both civil rights and religious aspect of it, actually, let's take all your community work other than the Jewish aspect of it.
Yeah.
Because you were on several areas. Yeah.
But let me say this, you know, we were doing all this, you know, with Alice's support. Let me say that I would say my top priority was still the family, though Alice may wonder about how that played into things.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about your sons, but we will.
Yeah.
But first, let's move into some of the civil rights things that were happening, and let's go back when you came back to Wilmington after your you got your degree from MIT.
Yeah, okay. I was living at the Y.
No, you came back with Alice. You were
I want to go back to civil. I can go back to civil rights.
Okay, go back to civil rights. Tell them I'm busy. So.
Okay. So I was still living at the Y, and I don't know how I got involved in it, but I.B. Finkelstein was concerned about the slumlords, you know, Herbert Drews was concerned.
Yeah.
Mrs. Pollack.
Oh.
Oh, tell her that I will, I'll call her back later this afternoon. So,
one event I remember is that I went with IB to a meeting which was held in a Y room, which IB paid for the general community. You know, there were some church leaders there and some people from the black community, okay, concerned about the behavior of the slumlords. And at the starting meeting, one black woman stood up and read a list of the slumlords, names of the slumlords, and they were all Jewish. After the meeting, I went up to her and said, "May I see the list that you were reading?" Actually, about one third of the names were Jewish.
Oh, well, she only read the Jewish name.
And the others were, you know, leaders of the community. Who were the other two-thirds? And she picked out the Jewish names.
Mm. That's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you call her on that?
I don't recall. I don't recall.
Mm-hmm.
And as I described the civil rights activities, you'll hear more of that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And there was
so more. That was done early in your career here.
Yeah, I was, you know, still maybe my mid-20s.
Uh-huh.
But I there was no follow-up on that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, Herbert Drews fought that battle for the Jewish community.
Yes, he did.
He was very much the leader in that, okay, involvement in the Jewish community.
What other involvement have in civil rights?
Okay. That, Alice and I very early. We were in town a few years. We had a couple of, just two children at the time, I believe. And I can remember going to Herbert Drew's and saying...
Rabbi Herbert Drew's.
Yes, yeah. And saying, and there were two little kids in the house. No, I guess just only David had been born. We were just in town back a year. And I asked Rabbi Drew's what I could do to help the whole community. And I can remember his response. He said, go home.
Hmm. And what did he mean by that?
He meant take care of your family.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Help your kids grow up, is what I'm sure he meant. But I didn't just do that.
Mm-hmm.
Alice and I then I served on a religious education committee. Ed Shaw shared it.
This is the Temple Beth Emma.
Beth Emma. And then about that time, Alice and I were asked to chair the Social Action Committee. Okay. And so early on, we got a call from a group called the Concerned Citizens, who were active civil rights people. There were a number of young Christian clerics involved, and we were, and I can't really name all the people. But at any rate, we were concerned with public accommodations, very quickly got involved, concerned with public accommodations, and Alice and I were among the people who picketed the Rialto as sort of an opening gun in that battle.
At Third and Market Street, the Rialto Theater.
Rialto Theater, Third and Market.
That at that time did not accept black people in the orchestra. I think they could sit in the balcony,
if I remember
rightly. But anyway, this was just sort of to dramatize the public accommodations problem, which was obviously much more widespread than that.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of the target point. When Rabbi Drew's resigned from the Human Relations Commission, he asked me to take his place. So I got very much involved then in the Human Relations Commission.
State of Delaware Human Relations Commission.
Yeah.
Right.
Which was reported to the governor.
Mm-hmm. And so when there was newspaper publicity, did you have any problem at work? Because I remember that time and there were newspaper articles and...
I can remember being quoted in one. At the time I had a supervisory job in the department, when I was about 40. And I can remember being quoted in one. I was picketing the Rialto. I never expected to be in this role. As a young supervisor at the pond, I never expected to be in this role.
Well,
but here I was.
So you were really involved,
yes,
from your position as head of that organization. But you were head of Concerned Citizens.
No, I was a member.
Oh, you were a member.
No,
sure.
I started off as Alice and I were co-chair for the Social Action Committee at the Temple.
Oh, at the Temple, right.
And that's how I got involved.
Uh-huh.
Then we were members of Concerned Citizens. I'm not sure we had a hand. It was a very egalitarian organization.
The Concerned Citizens.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I was a member of it too.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I knew it well.
Yeah.
All right. Well. So you can, I think the governor's commission actually was finally disbanded or something. No,
it may still be going as far as I know. But the roles changed and I'll tell you about it. I became vice chair of the commission. Then it seemed sensible for me to step down so that Gene McGowan, who was a black school psychologist,
Could become
the vice chair. Henry Herndon, Reverend Henry Herndon, Episcopal minister, was a chair and a marvelously effective person.
Yeah.
Okay. And by that time, public accommodations had been passed, and I chaired the housing, the Fair Housing Committee, mm-hmm. of the commission.
And so from that point?
We went to the governor and asked him, the legislation had been prepared to pass fair housing. We went to Governor Terry and said we asked him to sign, you know, to promote and sign that legislation. And he said to us, if you can get a majority of the legislature to go along, I'll do it. Well, there were a lot of commissioners, you know, all over the state. We then went out to all the legislators. And
you spread out.
Yeah,
to their own legislators.
Yeah, and where we generally had contacts.
Uh-huh.
And I went to Louise Connor, who was the senator from our district, who I didn't know at all, but she invited me to her home. And Bill, who was later the county executive,
right,
was there too, was working for DuPont as a lawyer at that time. And I talked to them, and they said, well, let's think it over. Louise said, well, let me think it over. And she came on board, mm. big time. She was a huge supporter.
Mm.
And it was logical.
Yeah.
Okay, it was logical for any
thinking,
fair,
yeah.
for any fair thinking person. And then that's what she surely was. And she led it for the Republican Party, and later lost her seat on account of it.
Hmm.
Yeah. We got him in. We worked all summer, as I recall. And by George, we did it.
Hmm.
We went back to the governor and told him, and he's, you know, who and who and who, and we told him, and his jaw dropped.
Because he never expected.
Yeah. And he dropped it. He would not touch it.
He would not touch it. He went back on his word.
Yes, he went back on his word.
Hmm.
Then the next fall, Russell Peterson was running, and Gene McGowan and I